to another conversation around Play the New Game. Today, we're going to talk about values as part of our week-long conversation around values. And today, we're going to talk about values in money. And so if you have a particular line of questions or something that you want to talk about, please feel free to come out and join us at any point in time. Today I want to talk a little bit about reinforcing what we spoke about yesterday when we talked about values in business. And then I want to spend a few minutes talking to you about how do you organize your life around values and money, both in terms of the inner game as well as the outer game. And so we'll make a distinction today between self-worth and net worth and financial independence and financial freedom and get those distinctions clear so that we're on the same page as to definitions. And then we want to give you the formula for financial independence, which essentially is a three-part formula, like almost all of our formulas are. I'm a strong believer in the power of threes. So this is a three-part formula that you'll find very helpful in terms of how you not only spend your time and trade your time for money, but what you do with your money after you get it. And the context of the conversation, really, in terms of values, if you have not listened to any of our prior conversations on values, I would recommend and strongly encourage you to go back to playthenewgame.com at the blog and look at the March 19th, 2008 conversation. That was the beginning where we spoke about the foundation of values. And then again yesterday we talked about values and business. And the context of values and business, we use the model of love, serve, and obey. And you're going to see that theme come over and over and over, because it's really a great metaphor for all of the values work, whatever it may be. And as values are applied to business, money, life, and any other aspect that you want. And so yesterday we talked about this three-dimensional value model. And so today I want to just relate it a little bit more to business and entrepreneurship, because obviously entrepreneurship is not only in your business aspect of values, but it also flows into your money aspect of values as well. And why this three-dimensional model is so critical, because we're always faced with values choices. You know, if you have to go out of town on a business trip to make money to feed your family, and that requires you to leave your family, well, there's a values conflict right there. And there's always this collision of values in these three dimensions. So today we're going to talk about how does all that affect money, and really I would love for you to participate because that's what really makes this thing come alive, as opposed to me just, you know, droning on here. And if you've joined us and you want to say hi, you're welcome to. Anybody join us? I believe somebody joined us. Want to say hi?
It's Wayne from Clearwater.
Hey, Wayne. Good to have you again.
Hey.
Thanks for joining us. And so let me just reiterate the foundational model of this values paradigm that we're coming from. And again, this is not the only model in the world, but it is what I found to be the most effective way to order your hierarchy of what's important. And it's a relatively simple model because it's three-dimensional. And everything essentially does fit into one of these three dimensions. In fact, every decision that we make, every choice that we make, probably each of these dimensions has, there's an implication, a consequence, as well as a payoff for each of these dimensions. So again, back to the analogy of, you know, if you have to travel to go out of town to make some money, you're away from your family, on the intrinsic dimension, you miss your kids, your family, your loved ones, because that's irreplaceable time that you cannot get back. On the extrinsic level, you're out there making money, which provides food and shelter and clothing and luxuries and everything else, pragmatic material for your family. It's also a way for you to get extrinsic satisfaction in your work and the things that you do socially. And then there's the systemic, which is essentially, you know, am I moving myself closer to my goal? Is this thing that I'm doing taking me away from where I really want to be, or is this keeping me on course? Or you may have a systemic challenge in that if you're away from your business for whatever length of time, maybe your business doesn't operate as well. Maybe the organization suffers as a result of you being away. So every day we're faced with values choices, and because we can only put our personal attention on one thing at a time, even those of us who like to believe that we're multitasking and doing many things at a time, we know the truth is that we're not, that we can only put our attention on one thing at a time. So the question becomes, where do you put your attention? And from a financial perspective, I even want to pose the challenge to you, because it's been a challenge for me. What if you're not really motivated by money? That's a real challenge for a good percentage of people, not only people who are employed by others, by other companies, but people who are self-employed. I am motivated by money, but money is not my primary motivation. And so when your values are such that what motivates you, let's say, for example, for me, it's service, number one, a mission, number two, a sense of belonging, and money. And so what happens if money is not on the top of my list? Does that make me less successful? Do I have to violate my values to go after money? All of these issues become central values conflicts if we let them be, or they can be easily managed once we understand more about what we really do value. And yesterday I mentioned stress. I mentioned the three afflictions that we are able to measure using our tool, the value profile, and the science of axiology. I measured three afflictions that right now are raging, not just in America, but we even internationally, when we run profiles of people of other countries, we notice now it's becoming cross-cultural. And that is that soul frustration, role frustration, and goal frustration. And so with respect to money and those issues, because yesterday we talked about work and business with regard to soul frustration, role frustration, and goal frustration. Now we can talk about those very same frustrations, but as they relate to money. And so are you feeling soul frustration? Do you feel like you don't give yourself enough time, that you don't have quiet time, that you don't take time for yourself to care for yourself intrinsically? That's one of the biggest areas of lack for people, and that doesn't require money to do that, all right? And then there's role frustration. So are you doing the things, as opposed to the soul frustration, which is the being, are you doing things that fit in alignment with what the roles that you're best suited to serve? For example, yesterday we were talking, and Peter mentioned about a professor at Harvard who's running a class to teach people who are all mega, mega financially successful people how to be happy, all right? And you say, well, geez, if, you know, these guys have more money than you could spend in 100 lifetimes, why should they not be happy? Well, because happiness and money and success exists on different dimensions of value. So I use the analogy of, for example, a janitor who could be very happy and joyful about his work if he takes his work and takes meaning from his work, and not so much about what he does but how he does it. And I brought up the book, which is one of my favorite, Chop Wood, Carry Water. All of life, no matter how complex the task you're doing or how simple the task you're doing, There's an Eastern philosophy, which, again, another values, potential values conflict, bumps up against the Western philosophy that says all of life, no matter how complex, is chop wood, carry water. And if you reduce your complicated tasks to the simple, everything comes down to chop wood, carry water. And another book favorite of mine, the title of which is How Do You Do Anything, is How You Do Everything. And so whether you're talking to an auditorium filled with 1,000 people or you're having an intimate conversation with one person, it's not about how many people are in the audience. It's not about what the power of the person may be. It's all about you. And that's the intrinsic dimension of value. And the extrinsic dimension is where you make your money. And so you've got this conflict, which is, you've got people making tons of money, and yet they're not happy. There's the intrinsic value of life is missing because there's such an overemphasis on the extrinsic value of life, all right, and all the things that are encompassed in that extrinsic value of life. And then you've got the third dimension, which we call the systemic dimension, which is really it's the thinking dimension, it's the conceptual dimension, and it's inside this dimension where goal frustration becomes a serious, serious stress factor. And at its extreme, goal frustration can make you very sick. And I know people, myself included over the years, who have literally made themselves sick chasing a goal with, you know, relentless pursuit. With the notion that that is the definition of success, not just the relentless pursuit, but the actual achievement of that goal. And in a society, in a culture that celebrates that as the highest level of value, it creates more conflict because not only do you sacrifice the extrinsic and the intrinsic when you're chasing some conceptual idea of where you think you ought to be, but it also can leave people very joyless if they come up short. If your value is all in the attainment of something, whether it's money, financial success, financial independence, a bigger house, a car, whatever that, you know, that thing is out there that you're chasing, if you come up short and you don't reach the point at which you thought you ought to have reached, it creates a tremendous amount of stress. And unless you manage that well, unless you're centered, unless you're relatively balanced and say, you know what, I don't care. However far I got, I got. I'm thrilled with what I got. And tomorrow I'll start again. That's a much healthier approach. And so money permeates this whole arena, just like when we talked about yesterday, values in business, that you could transform a business if you just elevated the ethos of the business, the philosophy of the business, the culture from obey their rules to serve the customer, you would literally transform a company. Now, of course, the more you teach people how to do that, the better the result. But even if they fumble it and you decide not to put any investment into teaching people the how, but they understand the why and the what, which is you, the what is you elevate from obey to serve, and why is because it's not only a better way to interact with your customer, it's a much more profitable methodology, it's a much more profitable approach to take. Now when you take that same hierarchy of value, the intrinsic, the extrinsic, the systemic, or the soul, the role, and the goal, if you will, and now you apply it to money. And so the first distinction I want to make is the distinction of self-worth and net worth. And I think it goes almost without saying, but we'll say it anyway, that we know that self-worth is not net worth and net worth is not self-worth. Yet, for a lot of us, and certainly in my life, I've conflated the two, I had my self-worth tied up in my net worth. And so if you don't have a healthy self-worth, separate and apart, and totally disengaged from net worth, then you will value yourself based upon what your balance sheet or your net worth statement, your total value says you are worth. If you don't have a strong sense of soul and self-worth, or if you diminish your self-worth, your self-value, your human value, your being value, and you diminish that because you haven't achieved that systemic state of financial independence that you ought to be at, well, then you'll experience soul frustration, all right? And it'll be sourced in money, even though it has nothing to do with money. It's just a state of mind. It's a way of thinking. And the nice thing about this model is you can apply it literally every day when you get up and say, just be aware that all of life exists three-dimensionally. So if I put too much attention on one dimension and take away airtime from another dimension, there's not much time left over, all right, then although there's no perfect balance, and we shouldn't necessarily seek perfect balance, because that's another fabrication, that there is such a thing as perfect balance, but just to be aware that when you're out of balance, or if you're veering off course, if you're spending too much time in the goal and you're not enjoying the role and you're not enjoying the soul, to be alert to it, to be conscious. And that's really probably the most valuable thing that we're talking about here is to go from that unconscious to conscious, to say, hey, I'm chasing that goal, but I'm chasing it consciously because I want to chase it, not because I feel like I have to chase it. And that's a huge difference. We could all, myself included, reduce our stress dramatically by being able to bring these distinctions to our work, to our money, to our relationships, to our family, and to our life in general. And that's really why I wanted to spend this week talking about the distinctions of value and how they apply to business, money, and other areas. Like tomorrow, we're going to talk about coaching. So to look at your self-worth and your net worth as two completely different things, yes, they are definitely connected. But there are lots of people who have very high levels of self-worth who don't value net worth as much and are very comfortable about that. There are others of us who say, hey, I have good self-worth, but I also want to build my net worth, all right? And that's a wonderful place to come from, because whether or not your net worth increases, it really will not have an effect on who you are as a person unless you make that connection. And it's a healthier place to be to not make that connection, so that you can pursue your net worth knowing that whatever level of net worth you achieve, it doesn't really change who you are as a person. I've always felt, having been around very, very wealthy people for a good chunk of my life, and also coming from incredibly humble beginnings and still very much tethered to the soul of people who don't have a lot of money, I have seen the gamut. And I've always felt and believed and seen it manifest this way, that money does not really change people. I don't see, and there's always exceptions, but most of the time, my observation of life is that money doesn't change people. It just makes them more of who they are. And so if you're generous and you're benevolent and you're kind, when you get a lot of money, you get more generous, benevolent, and kind. If you're stingy and miserly and have a scarcity mentality, you get more money, you just get more like that. Now, occasionally people do change. All right, but most of the time, money doesn't really alter who we are. So with that as a foundation, and the distinction between self-worth and net worth, which certainly you can make on your own as well, I want to make one more distinction, and then I'd love to talk about this formula of AIPI and RI, and how do we approach money from a values perspective to grow each of those three areas. And so this last distinction I want to talk about from a values perspective is the distinction between financial freedom and financial independence. And again, another easy concept or easy definition to conflate the two. And if you look at a lot of the promotions for business opportunities and entrepreneurship and investments and money and things like that, they put those two terms together. Financial freedom means financial independence, financial freedom, same thing, really. But really they're not. And from a values perspective, because we want to make distinctions when we can make distinctions, there's a huge difference. And so it comes down to the difference of financial freedom being a state of being, or in this case, from a values perspective, a state of mind, and financial independence being a statement of account. So financial independence is merely a certain level of economic wherewithal, call it net worth or income, where you can choose to get up every day and not have to work to maintain a standard of living that you feel is good. Now, I know people who don't make a lot of money yet are financially independent because their lifestyle is not extravagant and the income that they have coming in is more than enough for that lifestyle. And I'll use, let's say, $60,000 for an example of somebody I know who, you look at $60,000, you say, in today's world, especially, you know, in a metropolitan area, that doesn't go very far. Yet this person lives better than most people I know. And he's certainly not only financially independent because he's managed to keep his lifestyle below that, but he also happens to be financially free, okay? And there are people I know who make millions of dollars a year who are not financially independent because if they stopped working, they would not be able to maintain that level of income or that lifestyle that they've become accustomed to. Okay, so financial independence is purely a statement of account, and each of us has to determine what it is for each of us. So you decide what financial independence is for you. And if you use a very simple formula, you need approximately, if you look at 5% as a return that you can get almost anywhere with a reasonably big chunk of money, you could literally live or you could figure out how much money you need in principle to accumulate to live at 5% off the interest. So if you need $50,000 a year, you need $1 million. If you had $1 million and you never dipped into the principal and you could live on 50 grand a year, you would be able to live off that $1 million. That's your financial independence point, or the equivalent of $50,000 coming in if you didn't have that asset. And we'll talk more about that when we get into the formula. Okay? If it's $100,000 a year that you need to live, or that's your standard of living, you need $1 million, you need to get 10%. Or if you can only get 5%, you need $2 million. Very simple mathematics. That's financial independence, all right? Financial freedom, different place, totally different thing. Financial freedom to me, again, I'm using my definitions. You don't have to adopt them. But from a values perspective, freedom, like happiness, is an intrinsic value. It does not require an extrinsic number or dollar amount. It doesn't require a systemic goal to be achieved for you to have that state of being. And I always use the example of another friend of mine who I don't think he's ever made more than 50 grand, and he's in his mid-50s. And he is as financially free, up until a couple of years ago when he lost his job at least, was financially free as anybody I knew, even more financially free than another friend of mine who is worth millions of dollars, and who's as controlled by his money and fearful of losing his money as, you know, the person who's living homeless is fearful of not getting his next meal. You know, that's an incredible thing when you think the power of your state of mind to have literally millions of dollars and you could live off it, you know, for 20 years, even at $100,000 a year, if you had to exhaust it, and still not be financially free. You know, and then you take somebody who makes less than $50,000, who loves life, who doesn't have high aspirations, who doesn't necessarily, you know, look at money as an end in and of itself, would rather, you know, do things with for himself and with his friends, and that person's financially free. And unfortunately, in a lot of our, certainly the last couple of years anyway, you see screaming messages coming at you, you know, with the underlying message being you cannot be happy unless you are financially free, meaning really financially independent, all right? And I see way too many of these stories of people who were, you know, down in the gutter and here, and then all of a sudden they discovered FIRE, and now they're financially free, okay? And it's, you know, the phoenix story. I was down in the ashes, and I rose like a phoenix. And now, and what they're really saying is that maybe now I have my more financial independence, but I may not be as financially free, because what happens if I lose all my money, or if I, or if my income drops by 50%, which up until 5 years ago, maybe 6, 7 years ago, most people didn't concern themselves with that. Now all of a sudden, people who worked for Bear Stearns last week wind up today, this week, unemployed. Many of them, probably most of them, lost their stock, lost their pension plans. They're out on the street without a job, and they're, who knows, they may have worked there 20, 25, 30 years, and, you know, emotionally they're devastated, and that can happen. And that never used to happen, but it does happen now. And so there's a whole different place to come from to be happy, to be financially free, and that is, that exists on the intrinsic dimension of life. And so, you know, I always use the test. It's easy to be happy when things are going well, when you're in the flow, when money's coming to you, when business is good. It's very easy to be happy because your happiness is a reflection of the good fortune, you know, you're experiencing in the extrinsic world. If that fortune all of a sudden takes a turn downward, the question is, can you still be as happy when the extrinsic stuff or the goals are not being achieved as you are when they are? And that's not an easy thing to do. Yet for peace of mind and a healthy approach to money, it's good to be happy when you have money, and it's good to be happy when you don't have money, or as much money as you think you ought to be. And so when we talk about values and money, you know, I'm not going to talk about the hottest real estate investment or the new Forex stock trading approach, or is there a new annuity that just came out from an insurance company. Those are decisions that – those are tactical decisions that you make about – what you want to do with your money and how you want to invest your money, let's say, or manage your money. What we're talking about here is a whole different level of how you be with your money, and using the three dimensions of value and axiology as a great little guide to say, you know, when if I'm feeling like I'm off course, is the answer to work harder, or is the answer maybe to say, you know, maybe I don't need to consume as much, which, you know, that's almost blasphemy here in the United States to talk about curbing consumption. I mean, geez, isn't that who we are? We're not even Americans. We're consumers. So, you know, there's a lot of values issues around money. And so today I just wanted to give you a way to navigate through what might very well be a very difficult time coming up. You know, things are changing radically. And so having this model, although it may not make you more money directly, But having this model in your hip pocket can hopefully give you a way to navigate yourself through the waters, especially the choppy waters, and also to recognize that maybe curbing consumption, or in some cases actually getting rid of excess, is a very healthy thing. And that goes counter very often to our cultural messages, which is you don't cut back, you achieve more, you shoot for higher, you shoot for more. All right. Well, the challenge there is what ultimately becomes not only goal frustration, because if you don't get the more that you're chasing, not only don't you get the more, but you've given up all that time and life force to get the more, and soul frustration, because where is that more coming from? You know, it's got to come from somewhere. You only have 24 hours in a day. So if you're taking away from your soul, or if you're veering off course in terms of the role that you really want to play just to make more money, that conflict, that values collision, is going to come back to roost. And so now you'll have a model, you'll have a way to at least be mindful and conscious and say, hey, maybe I want to make a different choice. You know, maybe I want to work harder, make a lot of money in the next 5 years and then cruise. Or maybe I want to cut back. Or maybe I want to have a little more balance. I don't need the extra 20 or 30,000. Or maybe I actually do want to make the extra 20 or 30,000 that I can sock away for a rainy day. But you do it consciously, and you do it within a model of love, serve, and obey. Love yourself, serve yourself, and then obey the goals to the degree, or the vision to the degree that it serves and loves you. So now let me give you this formula, and then I really would love to hear from you if you'd like to participate in this. And this is the formula. Not for financial freedom, because there is no real formula for financial freedom per se, other than just feeling free of money, whether you have it or don't have it, whether you have a little of it or a lot of it. And it's not easy to do, because money is such a big part of life. And believe me, I've been there many times in my life where I've had the pressure. And so there are times where I feel free, where it doesn't matter how much money I have, and there are other times where I don't feel free. So freedom is that being state, whereas the financial independence now is actually a doing state. And so I'm going to give you this very simple formula. I call it the new game of money. And it's FI, which is financial independence, equals AI plus PI plus RI. So that's AI, active income, PI, passive income, RI, residual income. Okay, active income, passive income, residual income. And so those are the only three kinds of income. Those are the only three kinds of money per se. You actively make money, meaning you either trade time for money or you trade expertise for money. In other words, you work for it. Okay, so you make the money in active income. Passive income is your money makes money, or an asset makes money. Okay, so if you have an asset, real estate, stocks, bonds, traditional assets like that, or if you have another asset like, let's say, a book possibly, or a tape program, or some sort of intellectual property, or some sort of an asset that kicks off passive income occasionally, all right, that's your money makes money, or an asset makes money. That's considered passive income because you're not trading time for it. And then, of course, residual income. And residual income is the income like annuities. They continue to pay literally until the day you die. Okay. Residual income, some people have residual income from books and tapes and best-selling books and music, TV, rights, things like that. Okay, residual income. The most common type of residual income, which I also happen to believe is going to now face an unprecedented level of growth, and that is in the residual income you get from network marketing or direct sales, where people make you money. Okay, And by the way, affiliates could also be considered passive income. Now, internet affiliates who sell your products and services, those people can be out there selling, just like salespeople would be considered passive income, unless you're actively managing them. Let's say you had 10 salespeople, and all you did every day was, you know, get on the phone and say, how much did you sell all day? All right, that was your active work, and so for the most part, it's passive. So active income plus passive income plus residual income equals financial independence. If you have all active income and AI and no PI and RI, your financial independence is tied to your job and your income. You stop your income, you're not independent anymore. Okay? And I would even go so far as to say financial independence is not just being able to stop working and still live your lifestyle. That was the definition of financial, and that's the common term. Interesting, when I started in business in 1978 in financial planning, I did a seminar called Reality of Change, Shifting Economic Tides. And we talked about 5% of the people at the time were financially independent. One was wealthy, four were financially independent. Okay, could stop living, stop working, keep living, and maintain their lifestyle. Now that number is down to 2%. And I wouldn't be surprised if it continues to shrink further over the next 10 years to 1%. All right. And obviously things have changed radically. Lifestyles have dramatically increased, longevity, all right, and because people have been putting away money into pensions and things like that, now that are at risk, where in the past those things were really over the long haul not much at risk, not to mention the values issues that are surfacing in companies where the higher paid executives are leaving with literally tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars, and the pension plans of the people that work there are decimated. Okay, that is a huge values perversion that we don't seem to want to address in this country. All right, and it's not for this call. We'll talk more about that as we go along. But for today, it's critical to recognize that whatever your plan is, you've got to have AI plus PI plus RI. And what's ironic, what I see is really ironic in a way, and nobody would have predicted this 5 years ago, 10 years ago, is that if you really do want to get to financial independence now, it means that at some point you stop the AI, the active income, and you live off the PI and the RI. Okay? That's the purest definition of, quote, financial independence is you have enough passive income or residual income to replace your active income. Okay, so you go from being financially independent because you're able to work to being financially independent because your assets are able to work or other people are able to work for you. And so in an ironic twist of fate, we're sitting at a time unprecedented where the people who usually have the greatest security, those with AI, active income from companies that have been around and will be around, which is the greatest level of security, now all of a sudden those people, all of us really, don't have that same level of security. So AI, where in the past you would think, you know, passive income investments were risky, and certainly residual income, very few people had long-term residual income, all right? So most people counted on their active income, and at least they could count on that. Wow, things have really changed. So now the people who are, in an ironic twist of events, most stable, financially independent, are the ones that do have a fairly good residual income, because active income, not guaranteed, not even safe or secure anymore. Passive income, okay. If you've got a stock portfolio, you know what's happened over the last years. Obviously, it went way up, and maybe now it's coming down. If you owned real estate, investment real estate, commercial real estate, who knows what that might be worth today. Those are volatile, at-risk assets. All passive assets are at risk. Now, of course, on the flip side, if you invested in energy or invested in gold or whatever as an asset, well, you know, your asset value has gone up. Yet the question you have to ask yourself is, are my passive assets kicking off liquid income? Because there are many passive assets that may grow in value, but they don't afford you the opportunity to kick off liquid income. So I know people who are caught in the active passive income trap. They can't stop working, even though they have a sizable asset base or net worth, because that asset base is either in a non-liquid asset or does not produce cash flow-related income, or it's a long-term asset where a little bump in the road, or maybe a sheer drop off a cliff like we're facing right now, forces you to hang on to that asset because to sell it would, you know, be suicide economically. And that's another confluence of events here that we never experienced in the past. This whole coming together where all the markets now, except for a handful of particular types of assets, all the markets are at risk. Your active income is not guaranteed, not secure, and potentially at risk, unless you're in your own business, in which case if you're in your own business, you may or may not have as much security as if you were employed. Passive assets, again, at risk. And so here's the irony. The people who were most maligned, probably, of all people in the world, those dastardly network marketers, you know, those people who want to sell you the Amway products and the health products, the people who have taken the time to build that foundation of a residual income today are among the most secure financially. And other than those, you know, the 1 or 2% who are already financially independent and probably won't be much affected by the economic downturns or the shifts in things, those with residual income are stable. You know, they've got X amount of dollars coming in, and it might have taken them 5 or 10 years to build it, but now they could lose their job, their assets could go down in value, and they still have that residual income. So the formula is a very simple formula. How you decide to manage your active, passive, and residual income mix within that formula, that's a whole different conversation, all right? And we're going to have continuing conversations around this because the game has changed. The things that we thought were safe and stable and secure as active sources of income today may not be as safe and stable and secure as we once thought or as they once were. Those assets inside of the passive income part of our portfolio, if you will, may be volatile, may be down, who knows where they are, may be illiquid, okay? So you have to look at that and maybe rethink the game, totally reframe the game around what is a passive asset. And then residual income. I submit and have been talking about this now for a couple of years, and we're building a team to accomplish this. And obviously, if you're interested in our residual income or active or passive income sources, I'd be more than delighted to chat with you further. But here's my take on residual income. And I'm teaching my son this. He's 19. By the next year, he's going to be actively pursuing this. Because no matter what happens with your active income, no matter what happens with your portfolio income or your passive income, if you build a solid foundation of residual income, you are better insulated against the active and passive income fluctuations. And again, you know, this is a broad generalization, and there's always exceptions, and certainly some of us are in a position where our active income is very strong and probably will continue to be strong. But hey, I'm in a business that has changed 10 times in the last decade since the turn of the century. All right, so there's very little guaranteed. And you've got to be adaptable. You've got to be flexible. You've got to be willing to throw the box away and not get stuck in your old thinking about money and value and the mix of active, passive, and residual income. So what I'm recommending for people, and I spent 10 years as a financial planner, and certainly I've made millions and I've lost millions, and I was a millionaire at 32 and bankrupt at 34, so I don't stand here saying I have any unique wisdom. I'm just giving you the benefit of what I look back over the 30 years that I have been self-employed. And I would say that without question, no matter where I was today, actively and passively, that had I paid more close attention to the residual income, that I would be in a much better place today because of it than if I just said, hey, I've got my business, it's thriving, it's always going to thrive, I've got some investments, and now all of a sudden the market changes, the investments change, the active income is not quite as stable as it once was, and so you don't have that third leg of your stool to fall back on. So whatever your mix of active income, passive income, and residual income, one thing I recommend absolutely that everybody get over whatever their past experience was with network marketing, because unless you're an author with mega royalties, and there's very few of those, unless you're an entertainer or an artist, or unless somebody left you a big chunk of money with an annuity, chances are good you ought to consider putting residual income as part of your investment portfolio. And that's the way I see it. I see network marketing not as the hottest, greatest, latest. I mean, it's been around forever. It's just a marketing model. It's a money model. What I see it, though, as is the most viable way for you to get other people and get the benefit of working through other people. All right? Or if you have the ability to create residual income through memberships on the Internet, if you have a talent or an ability or a product or service or insights where you can have people coming back and paying you membership, that's more of a recurring income model, all right, than making a sale today and then making a sale tomorrow and then making a sale the next day and constantly being under the gun to make another sale. And believe me, I know that pressure firsthand. So now when you look at this mix of AI, PI, and RI, and you throw the box away and you start to recognize that very little is as it was, and probably very little is today as it will be tomorrow, now you can begin to look at what are my other choices for active income, passive income, and residual income outside of the normal realm of my thinking. Active income being, you know, my job or what I know how to do, what I'm trained to do. Passive income being, you know, look at my traditional investments and things like that. Or residual income for most of us, most people don't have residual income. Do you have residual income? Where is that residual income coming from? Is there a way that you could now over the next 3 years or 5 years, and if you don't have a model, we have a model. We can show you a money model, very inexpensive money model. Take $2,000 instead of putting it into an IRA, put it into a residual income. And so now as you begin to look at money, not just purely as a means of exchange, but you say, how does my money fit into my three-dimensional values of intrinsic, extrinsic, and systemic value of the soul, the role, and the goal, if you will? And then how do I want to develop my mix of active income, passive income, and residual income? What percentage of my time do I want to put into building active income? And am I not putting enough time into building residual income? Or am I spending so much time on my investments that I'm denying myself a chance to make an extra $50,000 or $100,000 a year of active income because I have a talent or a skill that I've overlooked? And that's very marketable. Or as, for example, some of our associates are aligning with us, we call them rainmakers. All right, and the rainmakers, they have their own businesses, they have their own services to offer, and now in addition to those services, they have our rainmaking services. They can offer either as a supplement to, as an add-on, as a lead-in, as a back-end, as a front-end, they can walk in and offer profit improvement services. They can offer rainmaking services. Possibly they can offer assessments using our value profile and walking into an opportunity where maybe instead of walking out with nothing, you walk out with a slice of the pie because you've got something now in your arsenal that you didn't have before when you were completely relying upon your own knowledge base or your own experience. And that requires a major shift in thinking. One of the precepts of the new game, one of the key principles, is a question, are you a jockey or a horse? Are you better in the marketplace as a jockey or a horse? Meaning, are you better being the rider of somebody else's products and services, or are you the ride? You're the person who's the manufacturer, the developer, the producer, the creator or inventor of a product or service, and other people will then ride you into the money, okay? Critical thing to determine for yourself. Am I more of a jockey? Am I better as a jockey? Because the people who are marketing to you, telling you to be an entrepreneur, are the people who have an economic stake in you becoming an entrepreneur. Meaning they want to sell you something, they want to sell you a business, they want to partner with you, they want a joint venture with you, or they want you to buy something, you know, a training program, an internet-based website, whatever. So they have a stake in telling you that, yes, you can succeed as a horse, all right? So you've got to divorce yourself from that. You've got to step back and say, am I really better as a jockey or am I better as a horse? Some of us are both. We can jockey and horse. So we create the product, and then we go out and sell it, and then we deliver it. We're the jockey, and we're the horse. So when it comes to active income, passive income, residual income, very few people can build residual income on their own. Now, if you happen to write a book and it becomes a bestseller, or you write a book and it sells 5,000 copies a year for the next 20 years, well, there's a source of residual income. If that's not highly likely for you, if there's not an affiliate program that you can create where you have 1,000 affiliates and every year 100 of them sell $100,000 worth of product and all you have to do is put the product out, wonderful. You've got a nice source of both passive and residual income, all right? So if that's not the case, then look at somebody else's horse. Look at somebody else who's already created a residual income vehicle and find one that's suitable, find a team worth playing for and playing with, and just hop on that horse and ride that horse. Just make sure that horse is going to be around for 5 or 10 years. You don't want to invest, you know, 3-4 years of your life and time and money and energy and wind up that horse, you know, goes off a cliff somewhere. Of course, no guarantees. So part of this conversation was about helping to make some distinctions from the point of view of values and money, and also the other part about making maybe remaking or reframing your financial independence game and saying, okay, how can I generate more active income even if I'm working and I'm getting paid well? Is there something I might be able to do, or is there someone I might be able to jockey into the money actively? Or passively, or residually. Now, if you're the horse, ask yourself the very same question. All right, whether you're a jockey or a horse, you should ask yourself the very same question. How can I maximize my active, passive, and residual income in the time that I put into making money? Because obviously you have other things to do in life too, like spend some of the money that you make. As well as personal time, family time, all this other stuff. So how can I, every day when I get up, how can I at least get the best return on my active, passive, and residual income activities, all right? And one day it may be it's 100% active income, or a week, or a month, or a year. It might be 100% active income. Another time it might be 90% active income and 10% residual income. Or maybe if you're heavily invested, it might be 60% is active income of my time, and then 40% of my time I have to pay attention to my passive income, to my investments, all right, because they're kicking off passive income for me. and maybe start to reallocate the mix of these three different types of sources of income in the context of, you know, your values, soul, role, and goal. And what will probably fall out the other end of that is you may not make as much money as if you put a heavy emphasis on making more money, all right? Or you might make more money. But what you will do is you'll find that place where, you know, you're feeling good about your values and your money. Just like yesterday when we talked about feeling good about your business and your money, your business and your values, that your business is more than just a vehicle of transportation to get you to a destination, that your business, your work, is actually an expression of what you can bring to the world, your contribution, your value, your performance, all right, and such that it's more than just, you know, business. As I say in the new game of business, it's not just business. It's personal. So that ends my part of this conversation, and I would very much love to engage you and hear from you. We are going to, as we move forward, we're going to let you know about the different opportunities and partnerships and vehicles that we have in each of these three dimensions, the active, the passive, and residual. All right? And if you're if you're interested in working with us in generating more active or passive or residual, please initiate a conversation. And you can either call or you can email Mitch@thenewgame.com. All right, and we'll be more than happy to talk about which of these three. More of what we have to offer is in the active income area, definitely in the passive, and particularly with the value profiles, which could be a very good source of passive income. And then we have a particular company that we work with on the residual income, although we have other companies that we know of that we can also suggest as well. So we have vehicles. Question is, do they make sense for you? Are they right for you? Can you make them work for you? Okay. So I would very much love to hear from you, your thoughts, your comments, your take on this. Was this helpful in terms of giving you some new distinctions around values and money? Come on out and please share your thoughts.
Mitch, it's Peter here. If you can hear me well, can you?
Yes, Peter. We can hear you.
The line's not too good. I'm struggling to hear you, but you touched a nerve with me. In fact, the passive income and the residual income side of things is what I am needing to focus on much more in my business now. I think you made a good point when you said earlier, if you stop working, you lose your independence. And that is, you know, one of my highest values is independence. And I'm more or less totally dependent at the moment on the active income side, which is really good. And I'm not complaining about that, but I've got to make the change to the passive and the residual. And so maybe it's not the time to talk about that now, but I would be interested in learning about the other opportunities you're talking about on the passive and residual income side, if they're complementary to what I'm doing, which it sounds as though they are.
Great. Yeah, and that's a unique way to see it, too, because we often don't think of our work enabling us to be independent. We just assume that. But it is really a direct correlation, you know, and we all know people who, when they stopped working, all of a sudden they were totally dependent. And for those of us who are, you know, self-employed and fiercely independent, and we do our business, you know, the biggest reason people get into business is what you just said, independence. You know, they just want to be doing it on their own. And, you know, I'm glad you brought that up because it relates back to jockey and horse, too. And I want to just, I'm so glad you brought that up, because sometimes, because our systemic thinking can get in the way, we where we're actually our own worst enemy, that we can add more value to the marketplace and we can derive more payoff from the marketplace, not necessarily being the deliverable. In other words, there are some people who are far more valuable in the marketplace in terms of the pure income perspective by riding somebody else's horse. So, for example, let's say you are a coach and you coach to individuals, all right? Or better yet, let's say you're a coach, you coach to corporate executives, and you work one-on-one or in small groups, but most of it is executive coaching. And that, let's say, just for argument, pick a number, 100 grand a year. You can double it, triple it, pick your number, it doesn't matter. But let's say, for argument's sake, that one of these corporate executives owns it up or operates a very big company that maybe does 100 million in sales. And beyond what your work is with that executive, that company is looking for a way to go from 100 million in sales to 110 or 120 million in sales. Now, if you're inside the box, or even if you're outside the box, it's highly unlikely that you're going to make the leap to say, if I knew somebody who could help you get that extra $20 million, would you want me to make the connection for you? Now, I'm not saying anybody in particular wouldn't make this leap. I'm saying, generally speaking, most of us limit our thinking about how we can serve others to how we can serve others. What's the scope of our own personal expertise or the depth of our experience? Yet, let's take this for instance. Let's say this CEO that you're coaching says, geez, you know, as a throwaway comment, I'm under a lot of stress because we have to grow our business by 20 million, and you know, and even though that's outside the scope of personal coaching, it's part of what's stressing me. It's part of what's contributing to my concern. All right, so a coach might say, okay, well, let's figure out how you can handle that. But what if a coach said, geez, I know a way that you can make rain. I know a guy who does a formula where you can find five different leverage points like we do in the Rainmakers. And it could very well be that he may be able to help you find a leverage point that could add $5 or $10 million. Would you like me to put him in touch with you? Or would you like at least to have a conversation, make the introduction? Now, normally, you might just refer that person and that's the end of it. But if you're throwing the box away and you're saying that in order for me to gain more active income, I don't necessarily have to work harder, more hours doing what I do, I could put two and two together and come up four, and if those two people I put together turn out to sell a $100,000 deal, I might be able to get a $10,000 or $15,000 or $20,000 finder's fee, or maybe a $25,000 or $30,000 sales fee. Most of us don't think that way. We're locked into our thinking about what our knowledge and experience is, and we limit our active income based on how we can better organize our own deliverable. And yet there may be a stretch limo sitting over here waiting to take you for a great ride, and you don't have to drive. You just have to sit back and be a passenger, and yet you're not even going to go into that limo because you're so focused on your own thing that you can't see to the right or left of you. You know, that's part of that old game thinking of, you know, you get your goal in sight and you never take your eyes off your goal and you keep it focused and you're laser-like and you put the blinders on, and all of a sudden now you realize there's a stretch limo sitting here waiting to take you there, and you're not seeing it. And so there's an example of how do you, you know, now it doesn't fit what you said, Peter, in terms of more passive income or residual income, but what you said triggered that for me. And I'm very happy that you did, because almost all of us have referral income power that we're not using. The relationships that we have, the work we've done for people, if we ever sat and just went through each person, spent 15 minutes with each person and said, what are you really looking for? What's your business looking for? And then we thought about all the people we knew that we could connect them with. All of a sudden, we could add 20, 30, 40% to our active income. that's happening right now more demonstrably online because you're seeing all these joint ventures that are happening where you build up a client list. I have about 5,000 people on who get my email. All right, we don't promote much through there, but there are people who have 500,000 people. And if somebody comes along and says, hey, we have this promotion, they say, well, geez, maybe one half of 1% of our 500,000 people would be interested in this. And they wind up selling 200 or 250 people at $200 or $300 or $400. Boom, they just added $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 to their top-line revenue with virtually no expense, okay? So that's, you know, throwing the box away and recognizing that as a service provider, and again, this is now the connection of business and money, that as a service provider, if you cannot provide the service, that doesn't mean the game ends. It's possible the game could just be beginning, but you're playing a whole other game, and you don't have to be the one to manage the game. You just have to get the people into the game. So thank you very much, Peter, for kind of stimulating that thought.
Okay, thanks, Mitch. We'll have a separate discussion, I think, later.
Okay. Anybody else want to come on out and, you know, make a comment or anything else that value that you've gotten out of this conversation? I guess.
Yeah, this is John.
Hey, John.
A couple of things. A comment on the freedom versus independence. I got some value out of that. I like that distinction. And the other thing I wanted to talk about was the jockey versus the horse. So what I realized, I think, is my strength is in fact being the horse. But because I'm independent, I'm having to do both. And frankly, I'm not very good at being a jockey. So.
Interesting. And are you jockeying your own horse? In other words, you're the jockey and the horse?
Essentially, yeah, because it's primarily service. On the product side, I've kind of got a mix of things that I do myself and things that I've taken from other people because they're complementary.
Right. But you're the you're doing the deliverable?
I'm the actual service provider. So,
okay. So you're you're selling some of your own, and you're selling some of other people's stuff, too?
Yes.
Okay. So whoever stuff you're selling, that's the horse. So you're both jockey and horse.
Exactly.
And you know that for those of us who are fiercely independent, don't like authority, love to run our own shops, that is both the blessing and the curse. You know, the blessing that we're capable of making enough money doing it our way, which is wonderful. And then the curse of actually, in a way, limiting ourselves because we don't let go of the jockey side. If we're, you know, if you're a much better horse, I'm a much better horse. I mean, I've been jockey horse for 30 years, but in an ideal world, I would be a horse because I've got all these potential money-making opportunities that we have in place, and I really need jockeys. That's why I shifted last year from being a jockey and a horse to spending a lot more time being the horse and less time being the jockey, and that's a bit of a transition.
Well, and my sense was that that's exactly the kind of transition that I should be seriously looking at. So you know, developing some strategies for handing the reins over to some people who are better jockeys.
Yeah, and the challenge, you know, that we all find is, when you hand the reins over to a jockey, you don't know if it's a good, if the jockey knows his stuff or not. And you know, it's like going to a doctor. For every doctor that graduated in the top 10%, there's one that graduated in the bottom 10%. And you don't know with the diploma on the wall which one you've got until you start working with them. So that's a huge challenge for those of us who are kind of in control and, you know, running our own place, is to recognize that some of the jockeys will not be as talented or capable as others, and so, you know, you have to be able to be willing to kind of settle for other people not doing it as well as you can do it, or other people not doing it as well as you think they ought to do it. You know, And what I would recommend for you, just as a point of reference, I mentioned the value profiles. I haven't even talked much about the specifics, but the value profile is a powerful tool in helping you to identify jockey horse, because we've got a couple of different reports. We've got an entrepreneur report, which measures the five critical categories of entrepreneurship: knowing what to do, knowing how to do it, planning and organizing, getting things done, and working with people. Those are five critical entrepreneurial skills. And within those five areas, there's about 25 different capacities that we measure. So that's one report that anybody who is an entrepreneur ought to have in his as part of his, you know, blood test, so to speak, you know, as part of his annual physical or twice annual physical. The other one is if you also either manage or sell, there's a report that we generate, which is a sales report. I mentioned it yesterday in the values and business conversation. You can see a sample at thenewgame.com/sales.pdf. That's a report that we generate, which actually measures things like self-starting ability and motivation and stress and handling rejection and empathy and practical ability and things like that. And then there's a series of management reports, assessments and screens that we can see if you're more of a manager than you actually market or sell, what are your best management talents? And what we see is a lot of companies, when they either hire a manager or they promote a salesperson to manager, that person is completely not suited to make the transition. Sometimes your best salespeople are your worst managers. You know, think of Michael Jordan as a player and Michael Jordan as a coach, you know. You don't even think of Michael Jordan as a coach because he's a lousy coach, and he'll be the first one to tell you. And he's actually not much of a general manager, although he's better at it now. But he was a super, he's the greatest maybe ever. So just because you're a great player, you know, doesn't mean you're going to be a good manager. And so the very same skills sometimes that make for good managers don't make for good players, or vice versa. So I would also recommend, if you're going through this transition, if you're looking at the transition, consider running a value profile 15 minutes, and then you can run these different reports to see which, you know, where are your best skills, and then how do you find people to compliment you. Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for your insights. Anybody else want to say something before we end for the day? Any other comments, questions at all? Okay, so from an action perspective, I would just leave you with this: is what are you going to do as a result of this conversation? And that would be your at least a step, an advanced step, something that you can measure. You know, remember, we use the famous, now becoming infamous, RAM formula to keep us on course for where we want to go. And it's the navigational tool. I've been using it for 25 years. I've shared it literally with a million people. I give it away because it's so important. Even though we used to charge a lot to teach it, now we give it away because it is the critical navigational tool to keep you on course for your destination. You can download that at thenewgame.com/RAM, R-A-M-M, two M's, dot PDF. thenewgame.com/RAM.PDF. And so decide what your result is, what action you're going to take, how you're going to measure against whether you're on or off course. And if you're off course, be willing to modify, be willing to revise, be willing to shift, and make the in-course correction. And if you don't let yourself get too far off course, like I have been in many junctures of my life, then you don't have to make a huge correction. You know, if you get off course 1 or 2 degrees, you nudge back, you gently correct, and you get back on course. If you don't measure and you wind up being way off course, it's much harder to turn the ship around. And you want to do it in increments, otherwise you wind up, jolting your system. So use the RAM formula, decide what action you're going to take, and And please keep me posted as to how you do. Okay, any other last comments before we end? Going once.
Mitch, your conversation on Thursday, is that going to be at the same time?
Yes, Thursday is going to be at the same time. We're going to talk about, what are we going to talk about Thursday? I don't remember, but it's going to be good. Tomorrow we're going to talk about coaching. We'll probably continue the conversation around coaching because this values model is a great model for coaching. And on Thursday we're going to talk more about values in you. In other words, how do you integrate this into your life more every day? So we'll be same time on Thursday.
Great. Look forward to it. Thanks.
All right. Have a good night. Have a good day. We'll see you again tomorrow. Go out there and play the new game. Good night.